Okay, welcome back to The Lonely Man of Faith, our explorations of Rabbi Soloveitchik's seminal essay on faith in the modern world. This is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs of Atid and the Web Yeshiva, and we will be looking at the third chapter of The Lonely Man of Faith, and maybe even get into the fourth chapter tonight. Until now, Rabbi Soloveitchik has put, by the way, I want to thank you all very much for the lively discussion that ensued last week, both towards the end of our session as well as during the intervening week, the very many intelligent, thoughtful emails that you sent, both those of you that participate live, also as well as apparently some of those of you that are out there following the archives. So if you're not on with us live, you're following along with the archives, we appreciate your feedback and your input, and of course feel free to send in your questions. If you are joining us live, I urge you to please turn on your video. If you don't know how to turn on your video, contact our tech support, Ezra Hurwitz. There you can chat with him in the box, or you can send him an email so that we can see you. It greatly enhances the experience. And if you have any questions or comments throughout, feel free to pipe up either by sending in a chat to everyone or to me directly if you only want me to see it, or by requesting the microphone if you don't have the microphone turned on, and we can all benefit from hearing your voice. Let me just check quickly who's on with us. A lot of our usual suspects joining us from all over the world. Chicago to Texas to California to Hawaii. Unfortunately, I don't see Poland online with us tonight, but I'm sure he's following along. Okay. Until now, Rabbi Soloveitchik laid out the general theme of the essay, set up a few questions by way of looking at this discrepancy between Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2, the two descriptions of the creation of man. He points to four particular discrepancies or differences, nuanced differences in the accounts of man's creation in the first chapter, as well as in the second chapter of Bereshit. And he uses that kind of as a springboard. This is something that a few people commented on last time and also during the week by emails, so I just want to reiterate this point. The Torah narrates the story of God's creating Adam in the Garden of Eden. It does so twice, in chapter 1 and then again in chapter 2 of Bereshit. These are two parallel descriptions of the creation of man, of mankind. They are not two subsequent stories. Somebody pointed out that they had somehow always thought that God had created man twice, although it wasn't clear to me what you know, the person who made this comment to me, what they thought happened after the first creation. No, there was one act of creation, but it's related twice. And the two different perspectives that the narrative takes, chapter 1 versus chapter 2, it becomes the springboard for Rabbi Soloveitchik's discussion. To be clear, The Lonely Man of Faith is not a kind of exegesis. It's not a perush on Sefer Bereshit. It's using these discrepancies in the narratives to act as a springboard for elaborating a larger idea. I think that it's an interesting question how Rabbi Soloveitchik came to these ideas. Did he look at these two accounts of creation and compare the discrepancies and say, well, here we're talking about two different aspects of what mankind is like, and each aspect must emanate from each of the two divergent accounts? Or did it work the exact opposite? did he have a notion of the different components of the human personality, the different aspects of what mankind is at its essence, and then found that reflected in the first two chapters of Breishit? That's a fascinating question, which we have no answer to, and I assume that we could argue both sides of that possibility. I'd be happy if this was a graduate seminar, or if it was a high school class. I might assign that as an assignment, a writing assignment, to argue one side or the other. If it was a high school class, we divide up, and have debate teams. What came first, the chicken or the egg? What came first, a sense of Adam 1 and Adam 2, which was then read back into Breishit, or a careful reading of Breishit from which grows these two personalities? Yes, also it's possible that the two reinforced each other. Until now, we've had a pretty detailed description of these two different personalities. If it's not clear to you, you should go back and reread chapter 1 and chapter 2 of the essay, or go back and revisit our recordings. Now he asks a question. Given that you have two different typologies of man, Adam the first, majestic man, the man in search of dignity, dignity being that thing which is socially constructed. Hold on. Right? Majestic man who seeks to master his environment, from the phrase in Genesis chapter 1, Vikivshuha, man is tasked to conquer the world. He is a utilitarian in nature, versus Adam the second, covenantal man, who surrenders his will to God, who seeks redemption, who instead of trying to master the environment is submissive to it, whose task not to conquer the world, but la'avda u'lishamra, to tend and to guard it. Each of them seeks to build community, but each of them is doing so out of a different impulse, and each of them seeks community to answer a different need. Now, when Rabbi Soloveitchik talks about community, it's not what we sometimes think of as community. Community is kind of like the neighborhood you live in, or maybe the shul you daven in, or the club you belong to. Here, community means more in the sense of communion, more in the sense of the world, your relationship to it, by force, your relationship to other people in that world. We sometimes use community just to describe, the other people in our zip code, or the people, and now we've taken it on to a whole different plane when we think of, our Facebook community or our Web Yeshiva community. Which is interesting, because most of us, have never really met in the real world, and sometimes it's even a little, it's a little, it's a little, I wouldn't say jarring, but it's a little, there's something strange about it. When I'll be sitting in my office and there's a knock on the door and Alan Goldenberg walks in, like that Woody Allen movie. What's that Woody Allen movie where the characters walk off the screen into the real world, and then the characters in the real world within the movie can then walk into the screen? What's that? It's yes, Purple Rose of Cairo. Correct, correct, Sherry. Right, and it's kind of like that. It's a little bit unreal. I mean, I wrote about this in a piece after our visit to Poland to go see our friend and fellow student Joel, that there was something a little unreal about it, because here's someone that I interact with on a almost daily basis, and have a relationship with and feel that I know, but I've never actually been in the same room with him. And when you do that, there's something almost unreal, because we do create a community, a virtual community. And so that's another use of the term community. I'm not sure that's exactly the way Rabbi Soloveitchik is using it, although there might be overlapping components here. So when he describes the different communities that Adam 1 seeks to develop versus Adam 2, it says something about each of them. It says something about each of them. Now, I mentioned in the link that I sent out yesterday, Rabbi Soloveitchik here is going to be drawing on ideas in philosophy, in political philosophy, about the social contract and the state of nature. Now, I hope this is familiar to all of you. I suggested you might want to dust off your Political Science 101 textbook from college, or look it up. And if you haven't done that and it's still a little fuzzy to you, you might want to do that afterwards. Even just a quick visit through Wikipedia on these topics of state of nature and social contract theory. Alan, if you could pop up those links to everyone in the chat. But I also sent out a link to, for anything, there are all these tutorials, any topic in science or philosophy or whatever it is. Even if you just go to YouTube, you can find a 3-minute Al Regel Achat video, summed up in a nutshell everything you need to know. But basically stated, there's a question in political philosophy. In the state of nature, the state of nature is a theoretical, philosophical notion. It's not a historical claim, but it's a philosophical claim that at the moment before man formed community, man formed society, we lived in a world without law. And it's a question, what authority governed us sitting around that campfire in the state of nature, this theoretical state that existed before we formed government and society? What law governed us? Was it a kind of inherent morality, or was it dog eat dog? This machloket, this debate, which is generally framed as a debate between Locke and Hobbes, the two great Enlightenment philosophers of the 17th century. Hobbes, most people's association with Hobbes is the tiger from the cartoon, the comic strip from the same name. But David, what's that link you put up? What's that go to? Is that the YouTube video I sent yesterday? Okay, very good. Here's John Locke on YouTube. 3-minute philosophy. Okay. Hobbes, the tiger, who when Calvin is coming around the corner, is liable to tear him to shreds. Hobbes is the one that said that by nature man is it's a dog eat dog, and the reason that we formed government, the reason that mankind formed government was to get on with our lives. That since in the state of nature, in a lawless or a pre-law society, anybody could do anything. That's not very productive because from time to time you have to walk down to the makolet to buy yourself a bottle of milk. And if every time you're going to do that, you're afraid, somebody's going to come along and murder you, it's hard to get anything done. So we all agree that we won't murder each other so that we can have the luxury of going down the block to buy a bottle of milk so that we can all get along with our lives. Locke was of a different opinion. John Locke was of a different opinion. John Locke was actually the most influential Enlightenment philosopher on the founding fathers of the United States. much of Thomas Jefferson's philosophy, particularly as it is then distilled into the Declaration of Independence and in his other writings, is very much influenced by the writings of the English philosopher John Locke. Locke thought that wasn't the case. Locke thought that we come together and we each surrender some of our own autonomy in order to I don't know that show. I've never seen that show. In order to accomplish more together than we could separately. These ideas are now echoed in the personalities of Adam the First and Adam the Second. Chapter 3 deals with the community of Adam the First. The community of which Adam the First, majestic man as a member, is a natural one, a product of the creative social gesture in which Adam engages whenever he thinks that collective living and acting will promote his interests. I term this community a natural one because the urge for organized activity at this level is not nurtured by the singular needs and experiences of spiritual man created in God's image, but by biological instinctual pressures. And here in the footnote, he describes this element of the social contract theory. It is a natural reaction. You're on the top of page 28. It is a natural reaction to the part of man as a biological being bent on survival, to the menacing challenge of the outside world. The outside world is brutal, and we form community to collectively protect ourselves from the natural world. In fact, the root of the instinct of gregariousness, which is the very foundation of the natural community, is to be found already in the animal kingdom. So in this sense, man is no different than animal. Motar ha'adam min ha'behema ayin. That in many ways, we discussed this actually quite at length in our recent study of the Rambam in previous semesters. In many ways, man is not merely no better than animals, but he himself shares a common denominator with the animal kingdom. So look at cattle grazing quietly along the wide area of green pastures. They sense suddenly that danger is lurking somewhere. What do the cattle do? They overcome by instinctive panic. They, overcome by instinctive panic, will begin to herd together and to cling to each other as if mere physical contiguity could avert the impending catastrophe. The cows will all bunch together in one herd, the herd mentality. And human beings, at least those of the Adam the First variety, meaning, again, this is not a historical description. It's not an anthropological description of how man founded community. It's an abstract theoretical argument, not in order to tell us what happened at the dawn of history, but to say something about man in the abstract. So Adam the First forms community out of a herd mentality. The difference between man associating with others and animals flocking together consists, of course, in the fact that while the mute creatures react in a mechanical, spurious, and purposeless way, eloquent and wise man acts intelligently and teleologically, with a purpose. Yet this discrepancy does not contradict our premise that primordial urge to come together in face of opposition is shared by both animals and by biological man. Biological man as opposed to spiritual man. Again, this nature that humanity, a human, is this hybrid between the two ideas expressed here in Breshit, that man is both created, B'tselem Elokim, in the image of God, but he's also afar min ha'adamah. He's also dust of the earth. He's a very corporeal, physical, gashmi, rooted in this world, but he also bears the spark of the divine and the paradox of man, the fascinating thing about us, is that on one hand, we're no better than the animals, and on the other hand, we're charged with being like the angels, with being like God in some ways. Sherry, hold that question. That's the purpose of these two chapters. Adam the First, and that's why Rabbi Soloveitchik calls this type of community of Adam the First a natural community, meaning it's a community formed by our nature, not natural in the sense of granola. Nature, that it's built into our biology. Our human nature is to be like this. That in principle we have no inherent need to be together with others. It's a purely utilitarian, functional one that we come together to be with others in community because of this sense of herd mentality. Adam the First is challenged by a hostile environment and hence summoned to perform many tasks which he alone cannot master. Consequently, meaning inherently, Adam the First doesn't need community. He could be the lone wolf. But there are certain things which technically cannot be accomplished on your own. We used to live in an apartment in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, you have this thing called a boydom. A boydom I don't even know how to spell it in Hebrew because it's not a Hebrew word. I think it's a Yiddish word. I'm not sure. But it's a word that we use in a boydom is like a crawl space. It's like usually like above something. It's not an attic exactly. It's hard to describe. I mean, those of you that live here know what a boydom is. I mean, we don't have them anymore. In our new house, we don't have them. But it was something that people used to have in the old apartments. It's like this little crawl space, like for storage. It's not like you can't stand up in there. It's worse than an attic. So we used to have this boydom, you know, we'd keep our suitcases up there and like other things that, you know, you don't need to get to on a regular basis. And they always say, never go up into the boydom if you're alone at home. So, you know, whenever you'd have to go up to the boydom, like my wife would say, I need to go up to the boydom. Let's do it when you come home from work. Why? Because, oh, look at that, there's an article on boydoms. What is that? Hold on. Ah, look at that. All right, you forward that to everyone. Alan, forward that to everyone. You've sent that to me privately. Why? Because once she did go up there alone, and the ladder moved, like as she was getting from the top rung of the ladder into the boydom, the ladder moved, and she was stuck up there. And fortunately, somebody else, like, it could have been that she would have been stuck up there, and the door would have been locked from the inside, and nobody would have been able to get in, and, you know, years later, we would have found her skeleton when they broke open the door or something. You know, so there's just certain things you can't do. I mean, I'm sorry, I apologize. I wasted too much of your time with this example. But you get the idea. There's certain things that technically you can't do alone. But the kind of relationship that you have with somebody, you know, who holds the ladder while you're going up into the boydom, it's not one of communion. It's not one of two souls coming together. It's a purely functional matter. But there's certain things that you can't do. You can't do alone, or it's stupid to do alone, or it's impractical to do alone. Consequently, Adam the First is compelled to take joint action. Man is compelled to take joint action. Helpless individuals, cognizant of the difficulties they encounter when they act separately, congregate, make arrangements, enter into treaties of mutual assistance, sign contracts, form partnerships, etc. The natural community is born of a feeling of individual helplessness. So this natural community, the kind of community which is formed, the herd mentality community, which is formed by Adam the First, comes from a sense of helplessness. But not only helplessness, because Rabbi Soloveitchik is also describing this sense that just sometimes it's impractical. Whenever Adam the First wants to work, to produce, to succeed in his undertakings, he must unite with others. The whole theory of the social contract, brought to perfection by the philosophers of the Age of Reason, by the 17th century Enlightenment philosophers, reflects the thinking of Adam the First. Identifying man with his intellectual nature and creative technological will, and finding in human existence coherence, legitimacy, reasonableness exclusively. To the thinkers of the Age of Reason, man posed no problem. He was for them an understandable, simple affair. He was like a cow. Cows are really quite simple. They chew a lot of grass. They give milk. And when you need it, they can help you get a steak. They stand around. There's a herd mentality. Their admiration, alas, adoration for the human mind, hindered them from realizing the metaphysical dilemma and existential paradoxality, indeed absurdity, embedded in the human eye awareness. They saw man in his glory, but failed to see him in his tragic plight. Now here we return to an idea that he touched upon in the beginning, that there's something tragic in human existence. And that tragedy is weighted on the side of Adam the Second. The Enlightenment saw man only on the Adam the First side of the ledger. And that's why they saw man's great power of reason, man's ability to conquer in a positive sense, his surroundings. It's not at all surprising in the history of ideas and the history of philosophy that the Age of Reason came after the Age of Exploration, 15th century, man getting on boats, sailing into the horizon, going off and, seeking out new life and new civilizations, quite literally. This idea that man is the master of the world, that on this comes a different way that people began to think about themselves and think about what it meant to be human and think about what it meant for man to live in the world and what our role vis-a-vis the world was, and to envision a very much Adam the First kind of definition of who we are and what we're doing here. And that caused them to overlook the Adam the Second component of humanity. It's also, of course, what led to the Enlightenment and new notions about the role of tradition and faith and religion. It's not surprising that the great Enlightenment philosophers, I mentioned Jefferson earlier, that many of these were not, certainly, obviously not atheists, but were deists. We don't have time to go into a little sidetrack on the history of religion, but those of you that know to what I'm referring, it shouldn't be surprising that that was the kind of turn in the history of religious thought that came about at that time. They consider the individual ontologically perfect and existentially adequate, but they overlooked the tragic component, the tortured component, the inherently, now again, Rabbi Soloveitchik doesn't think these are bad things. These are all ideas that we, in our kind of therapeutic age, think, well, if somebody has some kind of some tragedy or some angst or some, you know, something like that, they should, you know, just get it solved. These are not necessarily bad things. Conflict is not necessarily a bad thing. It can be the source of growth. It can be the source of, it can be the source of creativity. It can be the source even of redemption through tshuva. We'll get into that either later tonight or next time. They, the Enlightenment thinkers, the men of the Age of Reason, consider the individual ontologically perfect, existentially adequate. They admitted only that he was functionally handicapped, even though he could, like Robinson Crusoe, surmount this difficulty too. Robinson Crusoe is this idea that he comes back to, I skipped a page here. I'm sorry, I don't know how I did this. Hold on a second, let me find where we are. Robinson Crusoe is this idea that he comes back to again, the idea of the man alone on a desert island. In principle, Adam the First is Robinson Crusoe. It's merely a functional handicap. And we overcome the functional handicap by forming community. But forming the community is only to overcome the technical difficulty that, you know, we can't really get on with our lives and commerce and other things if we live alone on a desert island. But inherently, there's nothing wrong with it. Which is why, again, Adam the First is not what? What is he lacking? What's the one thing Adam the Second has that Adam the First doesn't have? Well, yes, okay, maybe there are other things that Adam the Second has that Adam the First has, but the main thing. No, I wouldn't say soul. He doesn't. No, corporeality. Obviously, they're both. I mean, corporeal means that they have physical. That they're real. They're either both corporeal or neither of them are corporeal because we're talking in abstractions. Yefeh, David, you win the prize. We'll have to figure out what the prize is. David puts it loneliness. That's exactly it. Adam the Second is lonely. Not lonely, I was careful to point this out. I was careful to point this out in the very beginning. Not lonely in the sense that we talk about it in the colloquial sense, but loneliness in that sense that painful awareness that he is unique and unlike everyone else and cut off from other people. Adam the First doesn't suffer from that. He doesn't sense that loneliness. He would be fine on a desert island, except for the technical problem that it's hard to get things done on a desert island. But if we could overcome that, that would be fine. And that's why the kind of community that Adam the First right, correct, Yefeh. In the chat, David is pointing out how he came to this correct answer. But in principle, there's nothing wrong with being alone. It's just that you're functionally handicapped when you're alone. It's hard to get things done since no one can really be a jack of all trades, certainly in a pre-industrial society. But in other words, if you want to be able to have guns and butter, if you want to be able to have both milk and meat separately, of course, you know, it's helpful to live in commerce with other people. But that's again only a technical need. If the individual is ontologically complete, even perfect, meaning ontologically complete in his being, in his nature, he's complete in the sense that he doesn't really need anyone else. then the experience of, here on the top of page 30, of loneliness must be alien to him, since loneliness is nothing but the act of questioning one's own ontological legitimacy. Ontological here meaning the nature of his being. So if he questions the legitimacy of the nature of his being, that causes loneliness. But Adam the First doesn't suffer from this. Questions his worth, his reasonableness. In fact, according to the biblical story, God was not concerned with the loneliness of Adam the First. Neither was Adam aware of the pronouncement, Lo tov heyot Adam levado. Remember that pronouncement, Lo tov heyot Adam levado, it is not good that man should be alone. And therefore, eselo ezer kenegdo, I will make him a helpmate, I'll make him a spouse. That is the description of Adam the Second. The inherent problematic nature that man should be alone. That is Adam the Second. Adam the First doesn't suffer from that. Because from the beginning, Zachar Nekeva bara otam, kind of built into creation is this independence. So neither was Adam aware of the pronouncement Lo tov heyot Adam levado, Adam the First. Right? This should say here, neither was Adam the First aware of the pronouncement Lo tov heyot Adam levado. It is not good for man to be lonely. Right? Rabbi Soloveitchik creatively translates Lo tov heyot Adam levado, which more literally should be translated as it is not good for man to be alone, but here he translates it to fit in with his figurative reading, it's not good for him to be lonely. No, I wouldn't say that, Sherry. I'm not sure that this corresponds with God before he created man and God after he created man. I'm not sure these things go together. Moreover, the connotation of these words in the context of the worldview of Adam the First, even if they had been addressed to him, would have been related not to loneliness, which is an existential in-depth experience, but to aloneness. And here he sharpens this distinction. To be alone does not mean to be lonely. To be alone is a practical surface experience. Adam the First, representing the natural community, would translate this pronouncement into pragmatic categories, referring not to existence as such, but to productive work. If you're alone and you want to do something that takes two people, if you're alone and you want to go up into the boydom, you have a technical problem. Because there are certain things you can't do alone. You know, like if you're like working, you're like a lumberjack and you've got one of those saws, you know, that's a two-man saw to chop down that big tree. So technically, you can't do it. It's a piece of equipment that can't be operated alone. But that's only a technical problem. It's not a spiritual problem. It's not an inherent problem to the nature of man. Adam the First, representing the natural community, would translate this pronouncement to pragmatic categories, referring not to existence as such, but to productive work. If pressed for an interpretation of the pronouncement, he would paraphrase it, it is not good for man to work alone, as opposed to be alone. Adam the First wouldn't understand what the pasuk means, lo tov heyot adam levado. He would assume he, in the sense that we all superimpose our own experience onto things in order to try to seek understanding. So he would say, it's not practically, he hears lo tov heyot adam levado, he thinks of the boydom. He thinks of the two-man saw. He would read the pasuk as Lo tov asota adam melacha levado. The words I shall make him a helpmate, eselo ezer kenegdo. God says it's not good for man to be alone. It's not good for Adam the Second to be alone. Therefore, I will create Eve. Would refer in accordance with his social philosophy to a functional partner to whom it would be assigned to collaborate with and assist Adam the First in his undertakings, schema, and projects. For Adam the First, Adam and Eve are created simultaneously, or at least according to the narrative in Genesis 1. Because it's a technical thing. For practical purposes, man wants to repopulate the world. For practical purposes, pruvu blu et haaretz v'kivshuha. You have to be fruitful and multiply, fill the world in order to subjugate it, in order to master it. So technically speaking, it takes two to tango. You need zachar u'nekeva. You need a man and a woman in order to populate the world. It's a functional thing. David, what's your question? I'm sorry? Oh, I see. Gotcha. I'll take a break in a second. I'll look at these chats which have been coming in. Eve, vis-a-vis Adam the first, would be a work partner, not an existential co-participant. Man alone cannot succeed, says Adam the first, because a successful life is possible only within a communal framework. Robinson Crusoe may be self-sufficient as far as mere survival is concerned, but he cannot make a success of his life. Meaning Robinson Crusoe can probably manage, before Friday shows up. He can manage to, get however many coconuts he needs to keep it going. But that is far from the definition of success. But on a technical plane, he needs to live in community. Distribution of labor, coordinated efforts of the many, the accumulated experience of the multitude, etc., etc., etc. Raise man above the primitive level of natural existence and grant him limited dominion over his environment. What we call civilization is the sum total of a community effort through the millennia. Thus, the natural community fashioned by Adam the First is a work community, committed to the successful production, distribution, and consumption of goods, materials, as well as cultural. I'm not certain. It's possible. Again, essays written 1965, height of the Cold War. It's possible the Rav is saying something here about socialism, about Soviet communism, about the kind of notion of the very limited value or the at best neutral spiritual value of a certain type of community. I'm not sure that's what he's saying here. I know that's a theme that he did address on different occasions. He was certainly not a fan of the Soviet Union, not just because in 1965 it was proper for an American rabbi to be patriotic in the way that you needed to be patriotic in 1965. Rabbi Soloveitchik had very strong feelings that communism was wrong, not just because it was oppressive, and not just because Russian Jewry, of which his family was part of, suffered in one way or another under it earlier, but he felt very strongly that the notion of a society which is organized towards merely production of work product was not the kind of society which could spiritually advance the goals of humanity. And again, he wasn't talking about Judaism per se. As I've pointed out before, the essay is not focused upon the Jewish man of faith, but the religious experience writ large. So he had very strong feelings about this. He apparently once said, I don't know if this is written any place or it's just the kind of, notion that he said this, that he said, the Torah proves that communism is wrong, because an entire sixth of Shas, one sixth of the Talmud, Seder Nezikin, is predicated upon the idea that there is such a thing as private property. The Torah has very strong. Now, to be clear, the Torah is not, it doesn't hold Donald Trump up as the model of the kind of enlightened human that we aim for. But we're not capitalists without reserve. But the idea that communism was wrong was a very was an idea that was very much at the forefront of his thinking. So I'm not certain that's what he's talking about here, but whether he is or he isn't, it resonates with these other ideas that he did visit from time to time. And then he points out this pasuk in Kohelet. It's one of the times where he does draw on a source. But again, to be clear, he, above the line, he almost never in the essay draws upon Talmudic or halachic sources, but draws upon biblical sources. The whole thing is built upon biblical sources, which is, of course, a common denominator to Western religion. So there's a pasuk in Kohelet. This is a chapter 4, pasuk 9, 4-9, in Ecclesiastes and Kohelet. It portrays the act of grouping and coalescing as envisioned by Adam the First in unmistakable categories. The two are better than the one because they have a good reward for their labor. Tovim hashnayim min ha'echad asher yesh lehem sechar tov ba'amalam. That two are better than one because, right, two heads are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. Meaning it's sometimes one plus one equals more than two. Meaning two people working together can sometimes accomplish more collectively than two separate people working on their own. The pasuk gives a reason for this because two people working together reinforce each other. Ki im yipolu echad yakim et chavero. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. Sometimes working together we gain strength and we gain encouragement from each other in a way that people working alone don't. But if you work alone, you don't have somebody to help you out. That's a description, this pasuk of lo tov, of tov mashnayim in echad, is functional. This is the kind of profit of working together that motivates Adam the First to form community. The natural community of Adam the First enhances man's chances for successful survival, yet does not elevate or enhance his existential experience, since the latter is in no need of redemption or catharsis. And here he touches upon the ideas, the themes of the community of Adam the Second, of which Adam the First has no need. Adam the Second has a need for redemption, for catharsis. Catharsis meaning purification. It's a Greek term, means purification. We generally think of catharsis as like a cathartic experience, you know, where you have this kind of emotional release, and you feel better after you're doing that. That's not exactly what it means in this context. This idea that you can overcome your tragedy, you can overcome the loneliness, the isolation, the horrifying experience of knowing you're unique, knowing you're alone, and that is cathartic. It is redemptive. It cleanses you of those feelings so that you can come together. But Adam the First has no need for that cleansing. He has no need for that redemption. He doesn't need to be saved from anything. He just needs somebody to hold the ladder when he climbs into the boedom. Adam the First feels safer and more comfortable in the company of Eve in a practical way, not in an ontological way. Adam and Eve together, it's practical. They can do puruvu, buluat haaretz. They can conquer the world. Because alone, you can't repopulate the world. Somebody can hold the ladder for you when you climb up into the boedom. But there's nothing inherent ontological in it doesn't change the nature of their being. He will never admit that he cannot, ontologically, see himself without Eve. They, Adam and Eve, act together, work together, pursue common objectives together, yet they do not exist together. I assume that each of us can think of married couples that we know that fit one model or the other, or more fit one model or the other. Again, these are kind of pure abstract types. Ontologically, they do not belong to each other. Each is provided with an I awareness and knows nothing of a we awareness. Right? It's 1 + 1 = 1 + 1 instead of 1 + 1 = 2. Of course, they communicate with each other, but the communication lines are open between two surface personalities engaged in work, dedicated to success, and speaking in cliches and stereotypes, and not between two souls bound together in an indissoluble relation, each one speaking in unique logoi. The in-depth personalities do not communicate, let alone commune with each other. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and the fowl of the air, and over everything that creeps over the earth. They're given a job to do. They're business partners. Male and female were summoned by their creator to act in unison in order to act successfully. Yet they were not charged with the task of existing in unison in order to cleanse, redeem, and hallow their existence. Okay, let me look. That's the end of chapter 3. The kind of... You can't say it's not a critique on the marriage of Adam and Eve the first. There's just no way around that, particularly when you consider that David, one second, I'll call on you in a second. Particularly when you consider that the essay is dedicated, Rabbi Soloveitchik dedicated the essay to his wife. We'll come back to that in a subsequent discussion. But it goes without saying that everything that we know about the marriage of Rabbi and Mrs. Soloveitchik points to the fact that it was not a marriage of Adam and Eve the first. Yeah, go ahead, David. Oh, wait, we need to pass you a microphone. Unmute. Why am I having trouble passing them? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Can you give me an example? Right. I think you're right. But again, all of those examples that you raised, I don't think we need to hear a debate, legalizing marijuana or gay marriage or any of those things. Those are all decisions that the community has to make when you're talking about community as, in its governance sense. Whether you live in a village of 100 people that elects a tribal elder, or you live in the United States of America, which is this very large, 300 million people, or so, with this large federal, state, local government, and you have to make decisions about, there's a speed limit, and we have to say it's going to either be 55 or it's going to be 65. And then we have to police ourselves. Those are the kinds of technical things, whether you're a libertarian that thinks that government should stay out of the way, even the libertarian position in the United States recognizes that the government has to do certain things. I mean, even the Tea Party, which thinks that, we should do away with taxes, doesn't really think that. I mean, they just like lower taxes, but they realize that somehow the road has to get built, and for the road to get built, somebody has to pay for it. These are all the kinds of functional Adam the First decisions that government makes. One second. That is community in the conventional sense, in the colloquial sense, but not community in the sense of what Adam the Second is trying to achieve, which apparently we're not going to be able to get to tonight. We'll talk about next time the description of what Adam the Second is trying to achieve through community. But it's not, but that's because that's the nature of what government is. That's the nature of the role that we've assigned to it. That's why it looks like the kinds of things that Adam the First is talking about. Did you want to say something else, David? Yeah, that does make some sense. I think part of the problem in public discourse comes about through, by nature, there's going to be an overlap. Again, Rabbi Soloveitchik is setting up these kind of pure abstract typologies in order to ex for this thought experiment. But in the real world, it's not quite so binary. And there is going to be an overlap between the two realms, and that's where it gets particularly messy because, to go back to the way you opened the question, David, you get into questions of ethics and morals and divergent senses of right and wrong and questions of people being harmed in ways. Look, obviously, if Reuven, shoots a gun at Shimon, Shimon is being harmed. And we all agree, though, that that's the kind of harm that government has a role in getting involved with. But take a more complicated scenario, and I'm not addressing it from a halachic perspective, but I just bring it because it's an easy example. Abortion. Well, the fetus is obviously in some way being harmed, and let's make it not a clear-cut case of the health of the mother or the life of the mother, but a woman's right to choose. Obviously, from a kind of objective perspective, most, I think would be clear that there's some harm being caused to the fetus, but a society might decide that a woman's right to choose would overrule that. You have values in conflict, and we're going to one camp is going to err. One camp is going to be inclined towards one value over the other, and the other camp is going to be inclined to a different value over the other. But since the conversation can't take place divorced from our a priori orientation and sense of right and wrong and how we go about in the triage of choosing those values in conflict to say which is right and which is, I'm making these air quotes here, wrong. So that's an example of the two sides coming into conflict, and the role of government is going to be to thrash through those kinds of things. But it's just a very common example of how it's hard to separate these two, the two realms from each other, because not everything is going to be parking laws. We've gone a little bit over time. Let me just quickly look at some of these chats. David, you had earlier mentioned this. You made this point about being careful about describing God and feelings in reference to God. Yes and no. In other words, Rabbi Soloveitchik was not careful to do that. And even though we're speaking somehow metaphorically about God, that's what we do, particularly when we're writing in a kind of poetic way. Alexander asks a question about what's the nature of Adam II's communion with the community and how it relates to his communion with God. That'll be the topic of next week. Okay. Hello? Okay. So I will sign off here unless anybody has any questions. And we will continue next week. Continue reading on chapter 4 and further. I'll send out an email as we go along. David, where are you joining us from? What university? Yeah, of course. What are you studying? What? Medicine. Okay. Good luck.